Morning, folks. We'll bring the meeting to order. We got nine? All right. Welcome, Ms. Hallback, from last week. I understand we're on hopefully the last day. I think it will be the last day. I don't know if that means it may continue tonight or not, but we need to be done today. So hopefully we'll rock and roll. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Just to refresh the record, my name is Myrna Hallback. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And in your slide packet, I'll be starting on slide 32. Slides before that were really a quick summary of what we did in detail over the spreadsheet, and so I don't believe there's any need to kind of go back and talk about those outcomes and that. And so I thought I would first set up a little bit of background before we talk about the 12 and 13 budget as the governor has presented it. And one of the important places is the reductions we have seen in the general fund in the last couple of years. In water, again, about $570,000. In the land programs, $565,000. In our environmental assistance, $1.5 million. And in the administrative support, $356,000. And then some in the special revenue.
Ms. Hallback, if I can interrupt, excuse me. Just members, just so you realize, Ms. Hallback is starting on page 16, slide 32. We covered a lot of the previous 31 slides or whatever in the overview. But if you look in there and see something that you feel is appropriate to ask questions about those slides, feel free to do so. Continue, Ms. Hallback.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so many of the unallotments that occurred in our budget were made permanent base reductions. So the unallotments that occurred in 10 and 11 were made permanent in our budget. Then I thought it would be helpful as well to look at the change in our budget over time and how the funding situation has changed. And you'll see in 2001, the general fund was a large portion of our budget, and it is down now to about 5% in where we are in the governor's budget. The environmental fund has grown, and part of the reason it has grown as part of our budget has been the merger with the Office of Environmental Assistance, which used some of the solid waste funds, and at the same time we modified how much of the solid waste tax was going to the general fund and how much was coming into the environmental fund. Used to be a 50-50 split, and then we were reappropriated some of those funds out of the general fund, and it is now a 70% goes to the environmental fund and 30% goes to the general fund to do. And then you can of course see in 10 and 11 the start of the clean water funds that coming in based on the amendment. The other part that would interest, I think, the committee was kind of the change in our FTEs over time, particularly the last decade. And again, you will see a couple of large burps in the system where we grew fairly significantly. One is in 2005, again, with the merger of OEA and the PCA. And then in 2007, 2008, when we began to have an increase in general funds for the Clean Water Legacy Act. And so we hired staff at that time to do. We were also at that time had a general fund initiative to support the mining and ethanol economic development activities, which we later brought into the environmental fund. You can see currently paid FTEs at the agency in 2011, this is as of February, there are 919 staff to do. We're projected in the 12-13 to be a 906 staff.
Representative Wiginius.
If you would just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand we gave extra money for ethanol and mining to subsidize those permits, but now you're saying that those that permitting process is being subsidized by essentially the waste fee, the fee that we pay on waste?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the Environmental Fund, the solid waste tax does pay a larger share of the revenues into that, but also there are permit application and annual fees that also go into that system.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. If I could follow up on that. For the mining and ethanol, I mean, we understand there's a subsidy for that permitting. How much is subsidized at this point?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I couldn't give you the breakdown based on mining and ethanol. When we, a couple of slides in, we'll have the percentage of what our fees pay, what the solid waste tax pays for that. But the purpose of creating the Environmental Fund years ago was to bring all of the fee-generated activities into one and then reappropriate it back out based on the priorities that the legislature wanted.
Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I think it's important that we know that number. And the reason is this. The people who are crying the loudest about wanting permits faster are not even paying for their own permitting process. They're asking somebody else to pay for it. So I think we have to understand, and I think the public needs to know exactly how much they are subsidizing this, because the solid waste tax was never intended as a subsidy for the ethanol and mining industries. So if we could understand that at some point, that would be helpful, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, on page 17, the graph that you have, the earlier one with regards to the budget trends, and then when I look in the book that we have on page 4 under MPCA, can you explain to me, please, to us, the discrepancy that exists in those two graphs? Got about $220 million or whatever for expenditures budget over time, and on page 4 it goes up to just about $400 million.
Representative Fabian, where are you at in the budget book?
Under the Pollution Control Agency, page 4.
Okay, Ms. Hallbeck, do you have that by chance or access to it?
My page 4 doesn't have a graph, so.
Can one of the pages hand Ms. Hallbeck that? Thank you, Representative Scott. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe the discrepancy is because the figure on page 4 is a biennial number and the graph in the handout is an annual number for a fiscal year.
Representative Fabian, does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hallbeck, you can continue.
Okay, now I have to. Okay. What I next wanted to do was just spend a little time talking about the interrelationship of the Environmental Fund and the remediation funds, and then how. So I'm on slide 35 now. In what, as we prepare documents at the close of fiscal year 2010, looking to the November forecast and how our budget preparation might begin for 12 and 13, what this relationship does and what we're trying to accomplish in the 12 and 13 budget. Do you know the Environmental Fund transfers fees to the remediation fund for activities done there? So that's part of the funding. So in 12 and 13, we're proposing for the Environmental Fund that there be funding coming in, so the revenue side of the Environmental Fund of $170 million over the biennium. 55% of that would be from the solid waste tax, so about $94 million. $49 million of that is from our fees and the permit applications, the annual fees, those types, and that's about 29%. The motor vehicle transfer fee is about $18.5 million and 11%. The metro landfill abatement fee is about $4.5 million or 3%. And then the other sorts of receipts we get in from either income agreements and that sort is about 2%, $3.9 million. So that was, I recall that last week we had a little conversation about what were the fees coming into the Environmental Fund. When you look at the remediation fund, we expect that fund will receive $63.6 million over the biennium. 75% of that is a transfer from the Environmental Fund. So under the budget, we're proposing to transfer $47.7 million from the Environmental Fund to the Remediation Fund to do cleanup activities. $9.4 million would be from the Petro Fund, transferred from the Petro Board to us to do cleanup and run the tank cleanup program. That's about 15%. There are some hazways penalties and fees that come in also from the emergency response, some restitutions. That's $3.7 million or 6%. And then again, you have small amounts of fees of $2.8 million, 4%. And so if the Environmental Fund is not balanced sufficiently so that we can transfer the needed funds to the remediation, Superfund cleanup, the closed landfill program, and the Brownsfield and our voluntary all will have to take reductions in the activities we do. So Superfund closed landfill programs have, you know, those are contaminated sites that need cleanup. So as we did the close of fiscal year 10 and we were looking out to what the next biennium would look like for the Environmental Fund, we saw a significant deficit approaching. That deficit and the look of it is basically because the fees did not come in as projected. So, as you might imagine, during economic slow times, we're not receiving permit applications. The solid waste tax fee was down, and we weren't transferring cars. Cars weren't selling, and so the motor vehicle transfer fee was down. What the agency was then obligated was to start to look at how we reduce our spending in order to balance this budget. While we're not the only agency that spends from the Environmental Fund, we are the major agency that spends from the Environmental Fund. So the budget we are that the governor is proposing accounts for how we would balance the Environmental Fund and still be able to accomplish the remediation work as proposed. Last week, one of the other discussions we had, as you can see, the environmental fund of the budget is about 35%, is what sorts of work we do under the environmental fund. This is where our regulatory work is, so our monitoring, our permitting, our compliance and enforcement, our watershed work, the SCORE grants that go out to counties, the household hazardous waste, our environmental assistance. So it is the bulk of the work that you see the agency doing is the environmental fund. What is transferred over then is Superfund, petrol, those landfill. The other way to look at our budget is not by fund, but by the media and the programs we do. So again, water is the largest component of our budget. As you look at our FTE breakdown, the water program is about 40% of our staff. You can see the admin component of it is about 12%. The environmental assistance and cross media is about 24%, and that is because within that portion of the budget, our federal dollars come into that activity. And so the cross media or our federal dollars come into that area. And so you'll see work that's done in monitoring, and our compliance activities are still done in that area, as well as seeing the SCORE grants and that sort of activity go out through this area. The land, for the most part, is our hazardous waste regulatory work, our tanks regulatory work, solid waste, and then the cleanup programs. When you're facing a reduction and a pullback in the activities, you need to look at focusing. One of the ways the agency looked at what it would do in the next biennium is really what are the key things facing us and how would we focus our staff and our work. So for 12 and 13, we anticipate really getting the watershed approach locked into a system, both our permitting and regulatory activities. Meeting the air regulations that are coming down, as we talked last week, the number of federal and changes in the air regulations that are activity.
Thank you. Representative Wiginia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say you want to lock in the watershed approach, I think we all, I think there's general agreement that we should take the watershed approach. How are you going to do that?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, we are really right now laying out all of our program plans that deal with water on how they will function and follow first the assessment, then following with our watershed plans, and then following with our permitting and our assistance programs in that same watershed to travel the state in a 10-year program. We intend to be able to rethink our NPDES permits by doing watershed permits and not facility by facility permits, so that they really all are working together to meet the same objectives. We intend that our limited construction stormwater staff are focused in on the areas that they need to be on those watershed. And so we're really reorganizing rather than just doing every permit across the state to do priority areas and meet those needs in it. And so right now, all of our managers are restructuring their program plans to meet that so that we can report out to you at where our staff are in the watershed and what are the results within those watersheds.
Representative Wiginius.
Yes. Given that, seems that it would be practical to focus our clean water money in the same way Does that follow for you as it does for me, or am I missing something here?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, that's exactly how we have proposed to use our Clean Water Fund money.
Continue, Ms. Hallback.
The other part of this, our focus, as we talked last week, is on the ambient air quality and the making sure that we do not go into non-attainment, and working in a proactive way with both businesses and the population out there to see what we can do to reduce those. And last, we have operational, and we talked last week about how to get our finance to our work to results, integrate it so that we can report out on a regular basis to the committees that are of interest here at the legislature, but also to the citizens, and actually publish that on our website in more real time than we're able to do it now. So when you want to know what has changed from quarter to quarter and how we've refocused staff, you'll be able to do it on the web. You'll be able to see what we look like in September, and you'll be able to see where we're focusing staff in February. And I won't be going back to do spreadsheets for you. You'll actually see it on time and be able to devote that and ask the questions from what you see on the web. And that will eventually be linked with the outcomes that we have going on. So what waters have been cleaned up? How is the air resulting from that? That is our goal, so that we're more real time, both with permit applications. So with the new change in the 150-day, how will we do more e-government? As I have talked with business and how we're invoicing, how do we invoice that all electronically, that you get one invoice from the agency, not three? So if you're a business who has a hazardous waste generator license with us, an air permit with us, and a water permit, you currently get three invoices from us coming to you at three different times in the first quarter of the year. We would like it to be one invoice and that you pay completely online. That's what we're moving to, and we hope to do it in 1 year. And that's where SWIFT becomes important to us as we move to the new financial system in the state to do. A little bit, we already chatted, so I won't spend a lot of time, but this again is part of how we are going to realign all of our work, and that means from contracting to those things that we need to do in databases and that, to make sure that the watershed approach goes and that we have 10-year looks at everything we're doing. So we monitor around the state to assess for the first 10 years. We get our watershed plans completed, and then we go back and we see how effective are those implementation plans to cleaning up the waters or protecting them. It's based on a 10-year cycle that all of our programs will be focused on. Again, quickly, just with the air regulatory, getting our permit, implementing the new regulations as they come, making sure that those who are permitted by us understand what those are, and the air toxics that we look at, pollution prevention, and work with all of those stakeholders. We don't do it alone, and we need to really take a proactive approach so we're not in non-attainment. And then lastly, as our staffing is changing and we see more retirements, we really need to proactively look at the workforce that we have left. What are those skills? How do we retain the knowledge that we do have? What do we need going forward? Making sure that our information technology systems are up and that can meet our goals. Updating the fiscal system. And so those are part, again, as I talk about integrating the business systems.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along with what you're saying here, one of the real challenges for our agencies is to keep personnel up to date with current science. That's a challenge in DNR. That's a challenge for you. I don't see anything about that. Do you have specific plans?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, that is exactly what will come out of the workforce planning, is what are those training needs to keep them updated, and where do we have to go to get them? Because a lot of that training is not necessarily within state, so how do we balance? How do we make sure that our scientists get to those national training events so that they learn it? But we need to understand what is the skill, what are the ongoing sorts. We also work very closely with the University of Minnesota so that we understand and we gain some of the knowledge they have. But we'll never be the same level of expertise as a research scientist working at the university where they devote all of their time to that.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the just observations I have made is that while Bowser and DNR have regularly asked to update their expertise using LCCMR money, PCA has never done that. And that's why I was interested in the how you were going to keep your folks up to date and to have the science that you can rely on so we're not spending folks' money in a stupid way, which we don't want to do. So just an observation, and perhaps under a new administration that may change.
Ms. Hallback, or comment? Okay, continue.
Mr. Chair, members, I would like to start now on the governor's initiatives, explaining those and where we are. The first one is a matter of course, the air emission fees by federal law increase based on the consumer price index. And so we have a set of rules and goes through, and so the increase will end up in the environmental fund. We're asking for the authority to spend it. Otherwise, it will set at the environmental. So the idea is to reduce our permit backlogs and do the rule updates. That's how the money would be used.
Okay, thank you. Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct me if I'm wrong, but if I do the math from FY12 to FY13 on slide 45, that's a tad bit more of an increase than CPI. So am I misunderstanding the witness's testimony when it was referenced to increasing by the price index, or is there an error on slide 45?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Qualm, there's a couple things on that I didn't go into the details of the rule. The other part of the rule that goes into the increases on it is, so what is failed to be collected in the previous year and the increase, and so there's a formula in rule that we have to follow that sets up how much the increase is, and then it's on a per pound of emissions that's generated, so based on whatever the fee itself may increase only a small amount, but depending on what's generated will impact how much we collect. And then the difference between 12 and 13 really is the 12 stays as that base and 13 is the second year increase.
Follow up, Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It may be appropriate if we received the explanation, including the formula for these increases, since doubling doesn't seem to come to me as a logical from the discussion. So, please make sure that the members of the committee get the information so we can understand the details for doubling the fees.
Thank you, Representative Qualm. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallback, can you help us understand that a little more? We have an autopilot fee increase that is dictated, again, did you say by EPA, or are there agency rules that somehow are involved there? I'm not clear on exactly how this works and where the authority comes from.
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the requirement for having the fee comes from the federal government. That's actually in federal law that we have the fee. The basis for the Minnesota rule is also in the federal law, but we have a rule that we had to go through rulemaking and come to the formula based on stakeholder impact.
Follow-up, Representative Jaskowski.
Mr. Chair, so Ms. Hallback, so the agency rule actually dictates the increase, is that correct? What I heard you say is the feds say we have to have a fee of some sort. I don't know, is there some sort of baseline attached to that or not? Maybe you can talk about that. But then we've got agency rule then that says that what that increase will be, and if so, when did that rule come into place, and what was the any background you can give us on that would be helpful.
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, the federal government on the fee rule sets out the basic premise for it, and then we did the rules. Those rules do have a formula calculated in it. It both has an adjustment factor for the consumer price index and then over or under collected, so that you make that adjustment to do. It also accounts for new applications and new fees so that you can make the adjustments in it. The rule has been around for, I think, 15 years before my time actually doing the air fee rule, so I'd have to look at the exact date for that. Last year we finished a rule process on the application component of it. I have been looking at the analysis of whether we should reopen this rule and its basic escalator that happens, because for the hazardous waste fee and for the application fee, we really looked at a cap on how much is collected and how you go about doing that, so that this, both this body and the public, plays in any increase that happens. So we have kind of a limiting factor of what are the other rules, and I have been talking to staff about reopening the air fees as well to look at that system, so that we have some input. It was based back in, even in 2000, where we didn't collect the fees that it cost to operate the program. We're now kind of breaking even on what it takes to manage the program and to do it. And so what are we going to do in the future as the escalation continues?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallback.
Ms. Hallback, continue. I'm sorry, excuse me. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallback, did you say that these fees, the rationale for the fees has been set for a while and you're going to reopen the rules? I'm curious as to what emissions we actually charge for. I thought I heard you say we charge by the pound or the ton. Specifically, are we charging for carbon dioxide yet?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are not charging for carbon dioxide.
Follow-up, Representative Beard.
No, thank you. It's good to know for a moment.
Continue, Ms. Hallback.
The second initiative that we would like to talk about is in our land program, in the Metro Solid Waste Landfill Fee. The governor's budget proposes an increase of about $1.5 million to be split between the Metro Landfill Abatement Trust and deposited in the Environmental Fund, which is then passed through to the Metro Counties. This initiative would eliminate the financial incentive to manage waste produced in the metro area outside the metro area. So currently, we have about 33% of the waste generated in the metro area being buried in landfills outside of the metro area. The fee that is in the metro area is based on waste generation. The fee in the non-metro area is based on landfill disposal. The landfill fee is based to help counties manage the risk we're having landfills in their area and the potential groundwater impacts and gas impacts. The metro fee was based on an incentive to have waste disposal reduced and therefore allow, really, as has waste was done in years past, an incentive: if you produce less, you pay less. And so it really encourages the waste reduction, recycling, composting parts of it. So this proposal would close that loop of being able to take metro waste to a non-metro landfill and avoid paying that fee.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallbeck, I'd like to go back to Representative Beard's question about charging for carbon dioxide emissions. You said that you're not planning to do that. Have you had discussions in the agency about that, and at what level?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian and I have not had discussions on that.
Thank you.
Ms. Hallbeck, were you done with slide 46, or did you have more to go through it?
I'm done.
Ms. Hallbeck, I'm trying to understand this. If I get what you're saying, we're trying to get involved in the issue of garbage leaving the metro and going out to be buried. I think the free market system today is dictating that it's more expensive in the seven counties, so they're moving outside the. And actually, it's not even only in the seven counties, because I believe some of it. Ms. Hallbeck, is it the seven county? Because I thought, isn't some of it moving, or is it actually moving outside the seven county? Are the lines the seven county?
Mr. Chair, the lines are the seven county metro area, and so waste within that has an incentive fee for that's used by the metro counties to reduce, recycle, do composting, and eliminate burial. And then a portion of that fund is also used then for the long-term care of landfills that existed in the metro area.
Thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. So we actually, if we do this initiative, waste that's generated in the metro will pay the tax twice, as opposed to if it stayed in the metro, or if it was non-metro waste generated out there, it would not pay it twice. So in other words, is that a true statement, that this would be the waste paying a fee twice, as opposed to if it stayed within the seven counties or originated outside the seven counties, it would only pay a fee once?
Mr. Chair, essentially that's correct. If you take your waste and this would pass, if you take generated waste from the metro county and bury it in any landfill in the non-metro area, you'll pay the fee that the local county imposes upon that, along with the waste generation fee that's in the metro county.
And Ms. Hallbeck, the rationale for paying this fee at both ends is the metro waste is leaving the metro area to be landfilled because it economically is more cost effective to bury it in a non-metro landfill than to go through a processing facility within the metro. The folks are figuring out that it's more economical to do it that way. The free market's dictating that, but we want to encourage more processing within the metro, and so by adding this $1.5 million to the cost of garbage, that would encourage more processing. Because I think, if I'm not mistaken, the agency's talking about the glass being half full and the garbage folks are talking about being half empty, and I'm trying to understand just how much water's in the glass and what's happening.
Mr. Chair, from the agency's perspective, closing this loop and this gap will do two things. One, it will limit the risk out in the landfills in the non-metro area. Secondly, it will provide the funds needed for the long-term care of landfills in the metro area that my agency is responsible for, because a portion of it goes into that. And secondly, it will provide the metro area counties additional revenues by which they can help reduce or recycle the waste.
Ms. Hallbeck, you mentioned about the risk to the non-metro landfills. Was that a risk of them filling up or a risk to the environment?
Mr. Chair, from our perspective, it's the risk to the environment.
Thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. Please continue. I'm sorry, Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, am I hearing that there's more environmental, are we not running the landfills outside the metro area in an environmentally sound manner, and only the landfills inside the Seven County are being run environmentally sound?
Ms. Hallbeck, comment?
Mr. Chair, landfills in the metro county and landfills in the non-metro county are both subject to the same rules and the same requirements.
Follow-up, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I must have misheard the statement that they're concerned about the environment outside the metro. Thank you.
Continue, Ms. Hallbeck.
Three additional initiatives under our land program include, first, the Petro Fund extending the sunset from 2012 date to 2017. This will allow the agency to continue to have both the staffing and the ability to work with those tank owners who have leaks and have contaminated soil, by which they do cleanup and then come back to the Petro Board for the 90% reimbursement. This is merely our portion of what the Petro Board would transfer to the agency. The reason this is an initiative is because the current sunset date would end in fiscal year 12, and so this would appear to be new dollars in 13. So it's really that transfer activity.
Ms. Hallbeck, is your proposal include a sunset on the extension?
It would still sunset in 2017, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I see Representative Hackbart nodding. I believe you're the author of the bill, Representative Hackbart. Thank you. Continue, Ms. Hallbeck.
The second initiative is really a no-cost initiative, but allows the agency to charge and recover the cost of permit applicants pursuing financial assurance for new types of assurance outside of what the rules require currently. So it would be merely, it's difficult for the agency or MMB, who we worked with to look at options available, to maintain that expertise on staff when it might only be used once in every 5 years or so. And so this would just be really the recovery of having someone in the industry look at the proposal and give us guidance on it. The last initiative is really a reduction in the administrative cost under the Voluntary Investigation and Cleanup Program. We have fewer sites coming through this, so we don't need administrative dollars which is staffing. And so this would fall to be allowed to do in the remediation program and actually be used for cleanup. So under the water program, one of our primary initiatives is to look at the wild rice issue that has been discussed by stakeholders on all sides. It would allow us to do plant toxicity studies and look at whether sulfate is the issue or some other impact to the wild rice stands, and then allow us to relook at the standard that currently exists, which was developed in 1973 based on the science then. So this would allow us to do the monitoring, do the science, and look at how we would amend those standards based on current science.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious on the, you mentioned the sulfur standard. I'm wondering what the standard is now in regulation.
Ms. Hallback, here we go.
Mr. Chair, it has slipped my mind.
Ms. Hallback, it's when it's enforced, it's 10 parts per, I'm not sure, maybe one of the scientists.
Part per million.
Parts per million. Representative Purcell would know that, yes. And it's very much a discussion point currently. Follow-up, Representative Hancock?
Evidently, it's been discussed before, but I really don't know exactly how that standard is was derived at, and certainly it poses some concerns for other issues that we're discussing. Any light, I guess, that would be shed on just how scientific that is. I understand that this is what the program is designed to do, but in terms of how it applies to what's taking place in terms of timelines, it seems important to me that we determine how this was established in the first place in terms of timelines of going forward.
Well, Representative Hancock, speaking of timelines, the data that's used to determine the 10 parts per million was the study was done before you and I were born. So I think we may be talking. And
maybe yourself, sir. I've been around for quite a while.
Representative Hancock, the study's from the 40s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was around in the 40s.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chairman McNamara. And I'm wondering if $1.5 million is going to be put forward in this biennium towards this study. First question is, has it been determined that that's going to be an adequate amount of money to fund the study, or is this going to take multiple bienniums, or do you have an opinion on that? And secondly is, there are other proposals out presently that use university different sources of funding to study the same issue, one through the University of Minnesota, NRRI, and some other different competing or not necessarily competing, but proposals. And I'm thinking that how would you interface with those studies, and how will all that, seems like all of a sudden we've got different ideas on where funding is going to come and go and accomplish and how that's all going to work together. And what's your thought about that? I'm thinking that we're going to be spending a whole lot of money on this, and it feels a little uncoordinated to me.
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, the $1.5 million first, just from the estimate, come from my technical staff back at the agency, and I did ask them whether they believed they had enough both for the staffing to do the project management and to understand it, as well as to do the research. The research component of this was intended to be done also with the University of Minnesota or NRI, depending on where, so it would be contracted out to do that research. The staff believe it'll take 3 years to complete both the research and going on, and that is much as they will conjecture right now as to where they are. Relative to kind of how we might approach it and the funding, it absolutely would be coordinated. This is the proposal we put forward as we developed the governor's budget on how to do it. I assume our coordination will be worked out as the projects move forward.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there any mining projects that are being delayed or held up because of this one test here? And you mentioned that it may take 3 years. So are some of these permitting applications being held up because of this one test?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know. I can't answer specifically whether they're being held up because there's a lot of information that goes into the mining permit process and the environmental review. But this certainly is one of the issues up in the mining areas.
Representative Anderson, I think how some of the projects have not been held up by the standard is they've agreed to this standard, that it will apply to them at a future date. Whether actually it's a current and applicable correct number, for lack of a better term, they've basically been held hostage by this standard, and they've agreed to meet it at a future date. Whether there's ever a new number or whether this number is the right number today, that's where they're at. Folks, this is a really important issue. We need to deal with this and find a way to make it happen. Ms. Hallbeck, you talked about working with different folks. Can you elaborate who are some of the folks that the agency has been in contact with about the importance of this study, some of the other interest groups involved, just so folks on the committee know that this is something the agency is taking very seriously of the importance. Who else are some of the groups that have been brought into the discussion?
Mr. Chair, members, I won't have the complete list, but we have talked with the tribal communities up in the north. We have talked with the mining industries up there. We've talked with the IRRRB, the University of Minnesota. We have talked seriously with the governor's office so that he understands the importance of it. So we've really, as we started this development, talked both to the science part, the University of Minnesota, the Environmental Protection Agency on the importance of it, along with the various stakeholders, including some of the environmental groups, so that we have a broad base on it.
And Ms. Hallback, when you mentioned the University of Minnesota, does that include the University of Minnesota Duluth, and I'm missing the acronym, but NRRI or whatever. Have you also been in contact with them? Representative Dill mentioned them in passing.
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe members of the agency have talked with them.
Thank you, Ms. Hallback. Representative Anderson, follow up? Or you're done, you're good? Fabian, Draskowski, third strike there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, can you give us, Ms. Hallback, a little bit about the genesis of the need, the apparent need for this, where it came from? Are wild rice stands disappearing? Have we measured what's happening in Ontario where wild rice is growing very well? Those are some questions I have. The other would be, where is the funding coming from now, and where is the proposal for this $1.5 million to come from?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative, really the genesis to look at this standard or any standard is we have at the agency, as part of our federal requirements, to do a triennial review of our standards. So we're really always looking at what the existing standards are, what is the current science, and whether those standards are appropriate. Sometimes that means the standards are tightened down. That means sometimes they just change in their applicability. As we're working with the mining industries, particularly up in the northern part of the state, the current standard in how it was generated has been at issue. We don't have the science to tell whether this standard is appropriate in Minnesota for wild rice, which would be the discharge standard.
Ms. Hallback and Representative Draskowski, what she just said is the very most important part. So if you would repeat that again, I think you laid it out very well, and it's important that people hear what she said. Could you repeat that again?
I'll try to. But we don't have the current science to justify the standard that we have. And so what we need to do is then look at what would current science tell us the proper standard should be? And of course, part of that research would be looking to Ontario and any place else that has wild rice. And what are the standards there? What are the appropriate?
The standard of 10 parts per million is extremely, has a big economic impact on things like wastewater treatment plants, any industry, including mining, that work near water where wild rice is an issue. We have to realize that wild rice is very, very important to the Native American community. It grows in places where sulfite levels are way, way above 10. There could be spots where wild rice is doing well in numbers exponentially above 10. We don't know. There was a study done before I was born, and I think before Representative Hancock was born, but it was done in the 40s. I'm hoping early 40s, Representative Hancock, than it is before you. But anyway, I think, Representative Drazkowski, it's important. The economic impact, we've heard from one business alone, if they're required to meet the level of 10, it could cost hundreds of millions of dollars in wastewater treatment for one specific business alone. And so we don't want to err wrong on what this level should be, and is there science to say where it should be at. Follow-up, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I certainly, if our standard is too low, which the guess is that it may be, I guess my concern is $1.5 million. Is there a shorter way to get to where we're going? Ms. Halbach, I fish in Canada twice a year. I'm willing to pull a water sample and bring it back if that's, you know, I mean... Is wild rice disappearing? I'm wondering what's going on out there. What are we seeing?
Representative Drazkowski.
I'm going to go to Representative Dill's resort.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to know why he doesn't come to my resort if he fishes twice a year in Canada. We've got excellent water.
You got to get those brochures out to the community. Out to the committee, Representative Dill. Representative Drazkowski, those are some of the good questions that unfortunately we don't know the answers to, and this is important that we do work together. We're not interested in wasting money, but at the same point, unfortunately, I think there are a lot of unanswered questions of where rice is not doing well, where rice is doing well, and is there a correlation to the sulfate level or not. This is one that the more I learn about it, the more I think it's important that we do understand it and bring all the different groups together and feel comfortable that what we're doing is the correct direction. Any follow-up on this? Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess it's just a matter of if indeed we're not sure that this... first of all, is it true that drinking water is 250?
The standard for drinking water, Representative Hancock, is 250 parts per million, 25 times this study.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Then my question would be is if we are asking various companies and mining industries now to comply over a period of time with a 10 parts per million regulation, that's really not a statute. My understanding is it's a regulatory thing. How can we base sound policy and the cost of implementing the standards that they need to adjust to based upon something that we haven't really established scientifically that's the regulatory practice that they should be? It would seem to me that we're putting a lot of power into the hands of the MPCA that really should be looked at by the legislature itself in terms of establishing the parts per million. I hate to see a lot of money spent. I'm a small business guy. I hate to see a lot of money spent in business trying to comply with a regulation that really has marginal scientific evidence.
Mr. Chair?
To this point, Representative Drazkowski.
Would it be cheaper than $1.5 million to just repeal the standard, realizing there doesn't seem to be a problem?
Representative Drazkowski, Representative Rukavina has a bill to change the standard. You may want to chat with him. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. may end up having to invite you all up here in August and September and take your icing up in my district, especially those of you who used to bale hay on a farm, and you'll find out it's pretty hard work. A couple of things. I guess I can't let it go by too awful. Mr. Chair, I apologize, but if I misheard you, but something about, I think you said something about sulfide levels are way above 10 in rice beds. And I think you may have meant to say sulfate, I don't know, but I'll just say for the record, what we do know about where wild rice grows, the sulfate levels are substantially below 10. There are some exceptions, but they are not orders of magnitude above. The highest that I know of, and I've done some research on this personally, was 12 in a rice bed. In my own personal research, they're in the 2s and 3s milligram per liter. It's sulfate level. But so I just wanted to make sure that if you have information to the contrary, I would like to know about it, and we need to know for this research that's going to proceed, because I've seen most of the literature on this over the last 25 years. Rice stands just appear, and Representative Gretkowski, wild rice used to grow all the way down the Mississippi River and the Caribbean along the shores. So yes, wild rice has disappeared, and a lot of that was due to various levels of sedimentation and pollution in the Mississippi River situation. In Minnesota, more of it was due to dams during the logging days. Wild rice is susceptible to the water level fluctuation, as you may know. One final thing that I want to point out. We're doing this, Representative Hancock and Drankowski, we're doing this so that we can figure out what that standard should be, if indeed we need that standard. But wild rice in my district and in everybody's district that has wild rice is so important to the fisheries ecosystem. And I think that's something that's left out. It's such a good habitat. We wouldn't have the fisheries that we have in Leech Lake, in Winnebagoches, Cass Lake, Big Lake, I'm just talking about my district, if we didn't have wild rice dens, because they provide that habitat for the young of the year fish and other parts of the aquatic environment. So it's important beyond just whether or not folks eat it. And of course, it has the connotation to the Native Americans, as you duly noted, that goes to the heart of treaty rights. But I hope I brought some clarification for you. There's no answer to everything.
Representative Purcell, as you know, my background's in landscape, so if you want to talk about the difference between swamp white oak and regular white oak, or Quercus alba and Quercus bicolor, I know that stuff, but sulfate, sulfides, to me, I get lost. So if I use one of those words wrong, I apologize. Currently, MPCA is assuming the level should be 10 parts per million. I don't know if today's science supports that. That's troubling for a lot of business and the implications for 10. It's troubling to the Native American community what potentially might be happening to wild rice. I think there's a lot of controversy about where it's growing, at what levels of, is it sulfide, Representative Purcell?
Sulfate.
Thank you. I appreciate your background and help in that. To this point, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I have a lot more to add. I'm troubled that we have standards that don't have any foundation to begin with, and I'm wondering why we have standards whatsoever in some of those areas. What impact does nitrate level have on wild rice? I mean, we could have standards shot in the dark in a bunch of these areas. I'm curious what other standards we might have that are not grounded in science.
Well, Representative Drazkowski, I appreciate your work on these issues, and I know when I left last night at 10:30, your pickup was still in the ramp. So your constituents are definitely getting their $31,000 a year worth.
You didn't open the door to wake me up, Mr. Chair.
Well, I didn't know that you were still here until I left, or I would have stopped by to say hello. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just an observation, I would suggest that repealing the standard at this point would be very problematic with the industry and with the Native American community. What's right for wild rice, a valuable resource, and probably even more particularly after going to a briefing on Friday with virtually every agency that's involved with mining, more particularly with the EPA. The EPA seems to be able to have a fair amount of say in this, as ultimately. And I think that a reasonable and fair assessment needs to be done, and that if it costs, if it's found that it is a lower standard and it costs a lot of money to meet that standard, or the current standard and it costs a lot of money to meet that standard, then that's what it should be. But if it also needs to be a higher number, and let's use Representative Rukavina's number of 50, or any other number in between or over that, then that's what it ought to be. And it ought to be based on something that we've determined with new and modern technologies, so that it can be validated and understood by industry and by folks interested in the rice. All of us are interested in that, and move on with the project. But to just take a nonchalant and wholesale look at this and just say one way or the other that it's right or wrong, or we should pass bills arbitrarily on it, is going to be the wrong course to take and going to get us in trouble in the future with this process. And as you said, this is a wildly important issue for not only the Iron Range, but for a community in Fairmont. If there's wild rice in the river, in their receiving waters, and I don't know that there are, but if there are, it's very possible that a permit, as you stated, Mr. Chair, could be a difficult thing to obtain for just something as simple, or what seems to be as simple, as a wastewater treatment plant. So, just an editorializing comment. Having been to that briefing last weekend, it was a significant eye-opener. Representative Purcell was there. Representative Rukavina was there. Many of us from the House and Senate were there. It was very, very enlightening. After 9 years of being here, I've learned probably more about this issue at that 1 2-hour meeting than I'd had in a long time. So thank you for this time.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I thank you, Representative Dill. I was at that meeting, and I just want to restate something that I said at that meeting, and it was to the point, and that you just made, Representative Drazkowski, that there's been an assertion out here that there's no science to back up the tent. There is, and it's rudimentary. It's not what it needs to be, and everybody's recognizing that, and that's why we're going to try and look at it. But there is science to back it up, but it needs to be revisited. As we revisit all of our standards, or many of them, I think in water quality every 3 years for the triennial review of standards. So we need to revisit these from time to time. Thanks.
The last comment from Representative Drazkowski on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, thank you, Representative Purcell. I would just urge us to see if we can find a way to arrive at a number that doesn't cost us $1.5 million. Thank you.
Ms. Hallback, I see we have about five different changes. I believe we're going to be able to make it, so hopefully we'll try and spend around 5 minutes on each one. But if one of them takes less, that'll allow a little time for more. Continue, Ms. Hallback.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Skip them. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Hallback, I skipped. Representative Hancock, did you have a comment? No, you go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say I was at the meeting also, and I don't dispute the fact that we need to have a good scientific study as to what the standards are. My opposition would be is why do we give agencies the regulatory power to establish such a limiting requirement, and if we review it three times a year, how come we're just now coming up with some of the problems? In other words, it seems to me that we sometimes extend too much regulatory power into our agencies, and that was the comment. Let's base decisions on good scientific evidence that we've paid for, but let's make standards that are so applicable let's make them at least reviewable by the legislature on a timely fashion. That was all.
Representative Knute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hancock and Ms. Hallbeck. I wasn't expecting to have a debate about science and agencies and how the legislature should be involved. And you know, I've worked on quite a few issues where science is really an important part of it, and I think legislators are not the people who should be debating science. And I think there's been a huge amount of misrepresentation and misinterpretation of very sound science from the wild rice is, I don't know enough about the science to comment on it, but looking at something like climate change and toxic chemicals and products, and I think there's a huge reason to have our agencies do this work and to do it well, so the people of Minnesota can have the information they need and legislators can have the information we need to make these decisions well. And I really appreciate that our agency wants to do this science well, and I think it's clearly an important issue for many people in our state, and I'm glad the work will be done, and I hope legislators are open-minded enough and willing to learn the science well enough to debate it in a respectful and useful way.
Representative Dale.
Well, I don't, this is in regard to what Representative New said. This is something that came from the meeting, and I guess I'd ask Ms. Hallbeck or whomever else. One of the things that the Corps of Engineers said at the meeting, and really took me by surprise, honestly, is that not all waters in the state are receiving waters. The receiving waters are not all wild rice waters. Now, living in the north, I can't hardly imagine that I couldn't find wild rice in virtually every stream or river somewhere. And so I wonder what qualifies, and is there a standard for that which determines what is a receiving water that constitutes a wild rice river? And are projects that currently, whether they be wastewater treatment projects or any other type of project, a mining project that we currently have on the range, who determines that and what standard is used for that? And I don't expect it, just a question I'm proposing. I'd like to have some information on that, because that kind of took me back in that meeting. Is I just assumed, I mean, every river that I live on or go on or recreate on has wild rice on it, it seems to me. But maybe I'm oblivious to the fact that there are rivers up there in my area that don't have wild rice on them. So that's something that I'd like to know as we move forward in this process.
Ms. Hallbeck, you're going to get back with us on some more information, and this one I know is evolving literally day by day. And next week when we dive into our budget, I am hopeful the agency will have the most up-to-date information, including Representative Dill's question in regards to this important issue.
Mr. Chair, yes, we will have the experts rather than me estimate.
Thank you, Ms. Hallbeck. I actually think that we are ready to continue.
The next proposal is again about allocating money to the agency that is already collected. We train wastewater operators as required by law so that they understand how to manage their facility in the most efficient and effective way for the environment. We charge fees for that to cover the cost of it. Those fees go into a fund that is shared with the Department of Health. This is just allocating those fees back out to the agency. The next proposal is the Clean Water Fund initiatives. And Mr. Chair, I didn't propose to spend a lot of time on each one of these since we do have the legacy division, but I thought it important to at least acknowledge that we are looking for these funds and that we have proposed. By the end of the biennium, for instance, we will have had 52% of the watersheds monitored. So that's an increase from 30 to 52. We'll continue our work on the load monitoring efforts. We will have 30% of the 81 watersheds with their watershed plans, the TMDL work, to do. We are proposing that we'll meet our federal requirements of having 100 additional impairments addressed during the biennium. And we're doing that on a watershed basis rather than impairment by impairment, so we really can look at it from a holistic effort. We'll continue our work in the groundwater assessment in support of the drinking water, and then also in the groundwater protection area to support our local counties who both do inventories and inspections and need additional resources to do their subsurface treatment systems. Not unlike the FEDOT program, our recycling programs, in that we partner with counties and they do the work at the local level.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Halbach. The $2 million over the next couple of years for the database, is this the first expenditure we've had for the database development?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, no. In the last biennium, there was $500,000 allocated for it. You will shortly be seeing the results of that first effort on the website. To do this is changing and making the data, both inputting the data into the system but also making it available externally, and then tracking what projects we have going on within the watersheds and the results that are coming back out from that.
Okay. And Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Scott.
Kind of a related question. Is this same sort of reporting and data keeping going on when it comes to the permitting process and those sorts of things?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it is. Our database for that, it is what we would call a legacy database. It's more than 15 years old. It's almost 20 years old. And it's on a platform by which most systems have moved away from, and the actual programmers are becoming scarce as the workforce changes. So we are looking forward at how we would change that and also make that the same availability externally.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Halbach, you mentioned the SSTS program, and it's obviously become a very big issue in my district, and several rural counties I know have gotten together recently to have some discussions about the standards and so forth. I'm curious to know, in your assessment part, the $7.5 million, how is that money going to be used to help our rural counties deal with the inventory and so forth? And then how does that integrate with the Bowser's program? Is there duplication?
Ms. Halbach.
Mr. Sorry. Chair, Representative, we really were the, if you think about this, the counties and the MPCA are the front end of that process, and the Bowser is the back end, the putting the resources out to improve a system that has an imminent health threat. Not unlike the FEDOT program, where we work with the counties to look at the inspections and look at what the issues are, and Bowser has the programs that help the individual farmer come into compliance and shape up his operation as he deems fit in meeting those rules. This funding that we're proposing here would actually be moved back out to the counties as a combination of their base grant, which is kind of their ongoing administrative dollars, and then as challenge grants so that they can update their systems, as we've heard from them, being able to do online permitting at the local level, having some databases there. We have currently working with a task force of many counties, and we would continue to do that to see really how to allocate this back out to the counties and allow them to meet the kind of operational system that best fits their county, which is the same way we approach recycling and the FEDOT program.
Representative Scott.
I just want to come back to this database information and the Office of Legislative Auditor. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't acknowledge you or Ms. Hallback. Why wouldn't the agency seek to find this information or this a new system through a private entity versus trying to just upgrade what the OLA claims is an archaic system?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, to the system that handles our permitting activities and that was actually designed for us and developed for us by a private entity. One of the options we will look at is, because times have changed, is can you outsource that? Can someone else manage the data in the unique way? Can they keep the connections? Because we transfer data to EPA in that. So you really have to look at the encompassing part of it. But it was designed and developed for us from a private party. And we're doing the maintenance part of it.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Hallback, how long ago was that?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, they began that in, I think the preliminary work happened in the early 1990s. We started with our AIR program in the 1995 and putting the information in and then brought online the various programs after that. One of the difficulties that you heard from the OLA was that each of our permitting programs and that are really built as kind of separate systems within a big system, so they don't cross talk to each other. And so that was some of the discussion on being able to get the permitting. That's what a new system today would look differently.
Just as a follow-up, Representative Scott.
I would definitely follow up on that. Technology has come so far, and I know that there are private entities out there that could interface all that. So, thank you.
Comment well made. Continue, Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of the Clean Water Fund initiatives left, and that is to continue our work in the St. Louis River area of concern in restoring the harbor and the work around the both in the St. Louis River and the Duluth Harbor. This initiative allows us to partner with the Corps of Engineers, the USGS, and other federal entities in the local partners in doing this work. The proposal that we have had, we've more than doubled the dollars the state has invested into this by other sources to really restore that harbor. Clean Water Partnership is not unlike the General Fund Clean Water Partnership Program. This accelerates our areas to do protection and those projects at the local level that they see. The last two are really about our MPDS programs and the needs for stormwater best management practices so that you know what's happening when you apply those practices to do. Mr. Chair, I'd move on then to the initiative where it would be transfer of the EQB staff to the MPCA and that the MPCA would support the activities of the EQB. There are currently three staff that would transfer from the Department of Administration to the Pollution Control Agency and allow us to provide more of the environmental expertise that the board needs as it moves on its projects. Ultimately, this is a $400,000 reduction to the general fund.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hallback, because in reference to this potential transfer of the EQB, what would be the resulting number of employees? Would there be a reduction in number of employees overall?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, there are three employees that are currently there. They would transfer to the agency. Currently, the executive director for the EQB is supplied by the Department of Administration and exists until October. We would envision that the executive director position may end.
Follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallback, the EQB, you know, it deals with more than one state agency, as you know. Do you feel it's appropriate that we house this within PCA when, you know, PCA is just one of the customers, shall we say, of the EQB.
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, we're merely housing the support staff to the EQB. The board would not change its function or its activity. All of those state agencies would still have their voice on the board and their authorities to make those decisions. What we're proposing with the initiative is really look at the future of the board and bring back next year to the legislature on how that might change in the future. But right now, there would be no change to the board and its activities. We currently all provide a technical representative to the board as it exists, and that would still occur. So I think where the staff sit will not impact the decisions made by the board.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Just one more quick follow-up. So then what is the logic behind moving this from admin to the PCA?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, there are a couple things. First of all, these staff are currently housed in the IT component of the Department of Administration, and so are not regularly supported by other people in the area. What is left in one of those staff out of the three is providing the local assistance as they do environmental review. As reported in the OLA, the MPCA does many of those activities right now with its environmental review staff, and we'd be able to shore up that support for the local. It's really about being more efficient and being able to support the activities in these times of reduction.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Hallback, this has brought a question in my mind. If we move the EQB to MPCA or those three folks, how is this board different than the citizens board at MPCA today? Would there be a need for that board, or could the citizens board and this board be merged together?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they do have two different functions, but what the study would look like is really what would the future of this board be, and it has different representation and a broader representation on it. It also has a direct connection to the governor's office as it was initially involved, and so really I think the decision will be up to members of the legislature on how it would continue and how it reflects with my board.
Thank you. Continue, Ms. Hallback.
At the bottom of this slide, in the last biennium, we were required to change from a statutory appropriation to a direct appropriation for the electronic waste program. This merely does that. So it doesn't change the funding sources. It doesn't change what we're looking at. It merely changes it so it's a direct appropriation and that you have more input into how we spend the dollars.
Representative Wagenia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hear, as do all these members, the need for the precious metals that to be mined that are in computers and other things, because that's our new society. We rely on them greatly. But I have heard nothing about making sure that all of the things that go in the waste stream are recycled and those precious metals are taken out for reuse. Is the agency working on that? What's going on in that in general? Or is
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fuginius, one of the grant RFPs that we currently have on the street right now and that we are looking for is exactly that, a recycling, how to recycle these materials and how to get them back into as a usable product.
Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And does that include the rare earths and those kinds of things, too? or is it just our traditional mercury lead type thing?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, we would like to take it to complete recycling if we can.
So that would include the rare earths?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Hallback, can you get us information, or maybe you know this, what's the current status? If I remember right, last year we were concerned that this program had been so popular on the front end that many of the folks were able to compile credits to an extent that there was going to be a challenge to make sure that the waste continued to get recycled. Where is that at today? Do you know that?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to get back to you on that.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful, and that would be good. And then the process, could you also let us know how you, don't you work with the different haulers and people that are working with this? I know I saw something in the media recently about, I don't think it was our state, I think it was somewhere out in the western United States, of somebody that shipped a load of this stuff, was headed to Japan when they had been compensated for supposedly taking care of the waste, but it was going to be, I don't know what was going to happen when it got to Japan, but it was not a good sign. So if you could, or do you have information now on that?
Mr. Chair, we do work with the haulers, but I'd have to ask the program exactly how it functions.
Okay. I would like to have more information on that important program. Continue, Ms. I'm sorry, Representative Hilty.
Well, Mr. Chair, this isn't a question as much as a comment, but just before Representative Wagenius asked about the recycling thing, I was sitting here wondering how many tons of rock we have to crush and process in order to obtain the same amount of material we could get from a single recycled computer. And I think that's something we ought to try to pursue an answer to.
Well, great point, Representative Hilty. I wonder how many tons of rock were moved on that load that was going to Japan where they weren't even going to recycle it. So, a good point. Ms. Hallback, I think we're almost through, but you might have a little more left.
Mr. Chair, I have one slide left. And this is to discuss the general fund reductions proposed in the governor's budget for the agency. The first reduction is in the Clean Water Grant Program of $215,000. This amounts to one or two less grants per year. The last two items on here are reductions to the general fund, but would be picked up in the environmental fund. So it's a shift of about 8 FTE to continue the work that is done under these two areas, and the first being our community assistance, which is really the staff that work with, it's got an odd name, but it's the staff that work directly with the counties on the SSTS program. The last one is our monitoring, both air and water monitoring, that are currently funded under the Environmental Assistance Cross Media, the general fund that would be continued in the environmental fund.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Help me understand why the appropriation to accelerate the clean water partnership with New Waters money is not supplanting your reduction of $215,000 each year from the CWP grants.
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, as we looked at each of the areas that were currently funded in the general fund, we tried to take at least as much or more under the other areas as we did under the Clean Water Partnership. So, for instance, we took 10% out of the Clean Water Partnership, which this amount reflects, that we would take more than that out of the others so that we were doing at least consistent across it. So we didn't believe it was supplanting.
Follow-up, Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We could, and this is for this committee to discuss, but we could get on this 10% a year which is the way we're going, and slowly just do the supplant. I mean, just slowly go over from one fund to the other. That appears that that's what is going on here. So that would be an issue for our discussion as we move forward.
Representative Wagenius, I think this will be a very much discussed point, but I think the reality, we're in a very tough budget situation. There will be substantial cuts to many parts of our budget. That's the reality. There is the legacy money that's out there, and it's going to be spent on a lot of good projects, and that's going to be the challenge for us to look at that and determine and follow the constitutional language. Is going to make for a challenge for sure. Point well made. Ms. Hallbeck, did you have a little bit left?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If I could just follow up for a second on a question raised by Representative Fabian on the SSTS program. It is controversial out in outstate areas. Does your agency have any funding available for folks if they have to upgrade and spend $15,000, $20,000 on an upgrade? Is your agency available, or Bowser, or where can people look to get some low-interest money to do an upgrade?
Ms. Hallback.
Mr. Chair, there are a few sources for folks to look for the upgrades. When it's connected to a project around a lake or a stream, we use the Clean Water Partnership Loan Program, so we have that, and many of the counties do use that program to restore it. The PFA, the Public Facilities Authority, has money available for communities, so you might think of 10 homes clustered together that have it to do. And then Bowser and the Department of Ag have loan interest, both grants and loans that they manage through that.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hallback, thank you for your presentation. You made it through the marathon. I'm curious, two questions. One is a real quick one. I'm curious if there were actually any layoffs during the last round of budget cuts with the agency, maybe in which areas those were. And then the second question is a general one, and I'm wondering if the agency could put together for us a list of your priorities by function throughout your agency into the next biennium. We're going to be working to put together our budget proposal here, and I would expect that we are going to be talking about priorities, because there are some areas we're not going to be able to fund and some areas we're going to be able to fund, and we're going to want to make sure we get it right. It would be helpful for us, and I put a letter together I'll give to you later, or a memo. I'm just asking for this, but it would be helpful, at least for me, to know what your priorities are by function, and maybe an attachment of an idea of what their funding levels are, their funding sources, etc., just in a short one-page type thing. Is that something you could do to help us out?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, yes, if I get your memo, then I'll know exactly how to structure that to help you understand our priorities. Relative to the layoff question, Mr. Chair, we laid off three individuals in the last biennium. We were able to bring back two of the individuals in our TMDL program because they had the skills that worked in that to do. One of them was permanently laid off. Those three staff worked in the educational area and supported the educational task force, which last week I explained that we ended our work in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Ms. Hallbeck.
Ms. Hallbeck, one question I have on the miscellaneous special revenue account. What is that account again?
Mr. Chair, miscellaneous revenue is split more recently by MMB into two kinds of monies coming in there. One is our indirect rate, so what the agency manages and receives from interagency agreements. So working with the DNR on the EISs would bring money into that. Our indirect rate would be into it. The other split from that was those revenues that are used, that are brought in by other agencies to us. For instance, the grant agreement that we have relative to our Green Corps comes into there. Expedited permits come into there. And so that can only be used for that overtime that we do relative to a permit in the air program, and so the money balances. So it's indirect on one component, and it's contracts and information coming in to from outside the agency.
So would that include permits like in the petrol fund, if you you have a track where you can do the regular be on the list to have your fund your claim processed in a normal fashion, or if you want to expedite it, you have some folks that work on that fund and you pay an extra fee of $1,500 and you get it done quicker than if you didn't, if you just waited through the normal process. Would those fees go into here then?
Mr. Chair, those fees that we direct charge would come into here. It's $125 an hour for those that we work with, the voluntary cleanups.
Okay. Thank you. Members, I have the minutes from the last meeting. Representative Fabian, do you want to move the minutes?
Move.
Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. Members, we'll be back tomorrow morning. What's today? Tuesday? We'll be back tomorrow morning. Meeting adjourned.